in the book, you use Twinkies as an example of a typical processed food, and you actually research every single ingredient that's on the Twinkies label, which starts with, I guess, bleached flour. We go through, let's see, we have eggs, and we have B vitamins, sugar, corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup, partially hydrogenated vegetable shortening, dextrose, cellulose gum, whey, leavenings, corn flour. And, of course, as we move on down, we do see that polysorbate 60 run along with soy lecithin and natural and artificial flavors. You actually went through the whole list. Why did you choose Twinkies?
Well, following that question from my daughter, quite seriously, I'd been thinking about that topic for some time, having done popular reference books on a variety of subjects, including beer and wine and so forth. I realized that in order to get into the world of processed food ingredients, which there are thousands of ingredients, I had to find a handle. And just picking the 30 or so most common ones wasn't interesting enough. Listing them all wasn't good enough. Picking them arbitrarily wasn't good enough. I needed one. I thought of the idea of having one product that was well known with an ingredient list that would lend itself to the table of contents of the book, that would work, and it did. It was when I came across Twinkies, I thought, oh my God, that's perfect. The ingredient list on the Twinkies label is the table of contents of Twinkie Deconstructed. And for that reason alone, I'm thankful for Twinkies.
Well, and Twinkies, like a lot of foods, a long time, has been around a long time, and it probably did start out fairly simple as a cake, a cream filling, and was made fairly naturally at one point. But again, shelf life is the big answer. Of course, the big joke about Twinkies is, you know, they quit making them 50 years ago. But in fact, that's why all these ingredients are in there.
That's right. It came out in 1930, and for years they were dogged by the problem of the cake spoiling on the shelves. And of course, no distributor wants to distribute fewer than the number of items it will sell, so they always had extras that were spoiling. It wasn't until after the war, really, that things got pretty serious in the preservative front and the artificial ingredient front. I don't know when the change came to the recipe. No one seems to, which is very frustrating. But then again, I'm interested in all these ingredients, not just Twinkies. But post-war, there was a huge drive for convenience food, and there were all kinds of chemicals that were flooding the market that had been discovered in the process of making, among other things, ammunition for the war.
Yeah, World War II had a big impact because ingredients that used to go into food were diverted for the war effort, and a lot of the processes for food went into the basic materials went to the war effort, so they had to come up with new ones.
Right, and I can't list it from that angle, which food additives were developed because of World War II, but I can tell you that glycerin, which was a very common food product and an additive, and still is, was in short supply in World War II and just after because it was being used to make nitroglycerin. So they had to come up with some alternatives, and that led in part to the drive to find what became polysorbate 60, one of the most ubiquitous emulsifiers in the world.
And it's basically what makes the cream filling creamy.
It's the key. What actually makes it creamy, I'd say the polysorbate 60 holds it together. Cellulose gum gives it that fatty feel. But it's largely made of oil. That's why it tastes so oily and heavy, like shortening, vegetable shortening. Basically, the cream filling, like your cheap frosting on birthday cakes, is Crisco with sugar.
Mm. No,
I don't find that very appetizing. But
Well, now, as you investigated Twinkies, you found out that the use of a lot of the processed foods increase the shelf life from about 3 days to 25 days.
Yeah, the official shelf life is 25 days now, and I think that might even vary a little bit, but you certainly can keep them longer, although not, you know, after a while they do start getting a little bit stale. They don't spoil, though.
Yeah. What was interesting is you ran into security concerns at nearly every step of the way as you researched these ingredients. There was company security at Interstate Baking, which is the parent company of Hostess. They didn't want you looking in their factories. Most of their food processing companies wouldn't allow you on site. There's even some national security concerns.
Yeah, I'm not so much with Interstate Bakeries. I think that was a commercial decision.
Yes.
And I don't fault them for it. But the some of the big flavor companies, they just were closed. One of them said, you know, if you'd asked us a few years ago for a tour or a visit, we would have obliged you, but now because of Homeland Security, forget about it. And other factories told me that they had what I thought were sort of normal-looking cyclone fences, barbed wire, guardhouses, you know, just for plant security in a tough industrial area. They said, oh, no, that's been put up since Homeland Security rules came into effect post-9/11.
In fact, one company asked you not even to tell where the location of one of their plants were, because it's a chloride plant that sort of helps create the ingredients that bleaches flour.
Yeah, chlorine. They make chlorine. Yeah,
chlorine. And they said, don't even tell us where the plant is.
Yeah, I thought that was sort of odd. I mean, it may have been that they just had a sort of formal policy of not talking about their location, because I can't imagine that they could hide it very well. These are huge plants, and they've been generally, none of them are new. They've been around making chlorine or whatever else they're making for years. But, you know, I obliged them, and, you know, I won't mention it. But I found that sort of funny. I mean, some of the secrecy is because they really don't want industrial espionage. But as I say, these plants are huge. It's hard to believe how, you know, I would reveal anything. But, you know, rules are rules. I ran into that. But you know what? For every door that closed, I found another one that opened. And I don't mean that to be Pollyannish. But I really worked hard on this. I did research over a period of years. So, for example, a dozen or more leads I had in the chlorine business, including from a retired guy who was so nice, he kept saying, call my friend so-and-so here, call my friend so-and-so there. They all dried up, usually because those businesses were gone, or the chemical businesses. We moved largely to China and India. But for others, like the chlorine, the guy said, look, you know, I can't really help you, but if you don't mention the plant name, I can describe it to you. And then I'd call another chlorine plant, and I'd say, look, you know, you got this factory picture on the website. It's like the annual report picture of this big, big, big company. Can you tell me, is chlorine made there? And he said, yeah, it's in that blue boxy building over there. So this is just looking at a picture with a guy. And then I'd ask him, well, tell me about it. He said, well, what's funny is, you know, it's a dangerous substance. It's highly secure. But that building is just a blue steel industrial building. Well, you know, that's the kind of fact that made it into my book. And then he proceeded to describe what it was like inside.
Yeah. Well, the book, Twinkie Deconstructed, goes through the entire list of ingredients in a Twinkie, and you go from how that product was created to the products that actually created that product were created. And you start out with wheat. Well, that sounds real simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
But in fact, there are six types of wheat. I never knew that.
I loved, you know, I felt sort of like, I should have known that. And then, of course, I'm learning this from people who love to talk about, say, wheat or baking. And everywhere I went, I just found tons of enthusiastic people who were glad to talk about their profession, out of professional pride, out of love for the profession. For example, with the miller, the guy who was milling the wheat, you know, he gave me samples of the six kinds of wheat and had me put a wheat berry in my mouth and try to chomp down on the hard one or the soft one to see the difference. It was really an education, and it was sort of obvious. I look at pizza, and I see, oh, yeah, high protein, stretchy. I mean, you don't have to be a cook to know that pizza dough stretches. You picture the guys tossing it over their heads. And cake flour is the opposite. No protein, no strength, no stretchiness, delicate, flaky. You know, it makes sense, and it's kind of nice to learn all that.
Yeah, in fact, what you found out was that hard winter and spring wheat, red wheat, is used for bread and pizza, and then hard white makes good bread flour. Soft white is noodle and cracker flour, and soft red winter wheat makes the best cake flour. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. Every one has a different characteristic, and then the millers have to be careful how they mill. It's not just a question of grinding them up, because all the way they mill it affects how it's how later it it expands or rises or what have you when you're baking.
My guest today is Steve Ettlinger. He's written a number of books on consumer products, and his latest is about the Twinkie Deconstructed, which talks about the ingredients found in processed foods. We see them on all sorts of labels, but it's very interesting how they're created, because most of these processed ingredients, some are grown, some are mined, some are drilled for. It's amazing what we're eating in these processed foods.
Yeah, it's a far cry from the fruits and vegetables that, in fact, should be the mainstay of our diet. Not that there's anything wrong with having a treat. It's just interesting to see. I categorized the 39 under three categories: animal, vegetable, and mineral. And they're pretty, well, the preponderance of vegetable sources, including trees, which I always forget are a vegetable, trees, and cotton is a vegetable. Don't forget, we use cottonseed oil.
Uh-huh.
Those were sort of unusual vegetables for me, palm trees.
Mm-hmm.
But the animals are few and far between. The chickens who supply some eggs and cows, of course, presenting, while not a straightforward dairy product, ultimately milk is converted into whey or caseinate or even, of course, now animal shortening, beef shortening.
Mm-hmm. But mining and minerals was the interesting thing. And the next one of the main ingredients is the vitamin enrichment. And this really takes you around the world.
Absolutely. That was probably the most surprising thing, to find that most of our vitamins come from China. In any case, all but one comes from abroad. Most of the vitamin companies that were making vitamins here in the country have fled because of a variety of reasons, not the least of which was bankruptcy created by lunacy on their part, but also labor costs and regulation.
Bankruptcy caused on lunacy on their part.
Well, a whole bunch of vitamin companies got together and fixed prices.
Fixed the market, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm drawing a blank as to when that was. It was about 10 years ago, I guess. So now some Europeans took over a lot of the American stuff, and there was a lot of merging and deactivation of plants and so forth. But I was invited to a little valley in Switzerland at the foot of the Matterhorn to see where they make niacin. Most of the niacin in the world comes from there. I didn't go. It was so frustrating, but I couldn't justify the trip because it was only a paragraph in the book. But, it sounded beautiful, but it's just a refinery. They make naphtha out of crack from petroleum and turn it into a white powder. That was just fascinating to me. A lot of the ferrous sulfate, of course, is made here by mixing sulfuric acid with steel in the steel mills. Not an auspicious start for a food product. but an alternative is elemental iron, which you'll often see as the iron additive in enriched flour, which these days comes quite often from India. Hmm. And the rest of the stuff comes from China.
Was it interesting to you that these basic ingredients that go into food are also used to make a wide variety of products? The glucose, form of sugar that adds sweetness to the crumb cake and the filling, also is used as to add glossiness to shoe leather and in concrete.
Right.
All these products are used, the cotton cellulose is used in rocket fuel.
Right. The cellulose gum in rocket fuel is one of my favorite industrial uses because I love the link of rocket fuel and Twinkies. although no one's saying that you could fuel, never mind, I don't want to go down that road. But the thing is, it's a gel. If you want to add your, create a sort of gel-like fluid, and you've got a very liquid fluid, you can add some cellulose gum to it. And I think that's just a riot. Same thing that I have a hand cream at home, Burt's Bees Moisturizer, glycerin, the same glycerin that holds the moisture in the cake, holds moisture in concrete, holds moisture perhaps in leather, or it's more of an old-fashioned thing, holds moisture in Burt's Bees hand cream.
Hmm. One of the things you investigate is high fructose corn syrup. Now, you can't go through a grocery store without seeing this particular ingredient in seemingly every product in the store.
Well, it's certainly in every category, and that speaks to an interesting point. A lot of people would have loved it if I could have indicted high fructose corn syrup for causing all kinds of dietary ills and obesity and all that. And I really didn't find anything that was definitive on that score, or in any case, studies stack up on either side of the question. But what I did notice is that, like you say, it's on every label. And we're eating it in places where we never probably expected to meet sugar. It adds calories to a lot of things. It certainly is a great ingredient for mixing stuff. It's got a different characteristic than just sweetening, which is that it's sort of an emulsifier. It holds moisture again. Very handy, very easy to use because it's a liquid.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of surprising, but even more surprising was I was in one plant, just one plant alone, where they make 5 million pounds of it every day.
That's a lot of corn syrup.
Lot of corn syrup, yeah.
Well,
and the trucks were lined up with corn coming in,
Now, in the case of Twinkies, you're using both sugar, from cane sugar, others from sugar beets, depending on which plant makes it, I think you're right. So they're using sugar, but they're also using high fructose corn syrup and corn syrup, which we think is a substitute for sugar. Why use both?
Well, I could never get a straight answer on that, or an answer that was, you know, concise. But the bottom line is the label covers all bases. It allows, by listing two or three forms of the same substance, they're able to switch from factory to factory, or maybe if they get a new machine in, they might want to use granular sugar. Another machine, they might want to use liquid sugar just because it's made for mixing things that way. The price might go up or down on one of the items and make them want to change their formulation ever so slightly. So they have to hedge their bets. So that there may be more items on the list than are in the actual cake because of that.
Is that similar for a lot of processed foods where they'll list every possible ingredient they could put in it and then they put in the ingredients based on the price of the commodity at that time and which plant's making it?
You know, I can't answer definitively. I would say that in the case of some items like that, like sugar, that may be the case. I would say not for the others, like polysorbate 60 or sorbic acid. They're always going to need those based on the recipe. Now, the recipe might evolve over time, but I don't think they'd list the things just in case.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you talk about the process of making high fructose corn syrup? Did you have access?
Not to the actual place where they make the corn syrup because of industrial espionage. When I got a tour around, or worries about an industrial espionage, when I got a tour around that plant, the plant manager, who by the way, these big plants, they're multi-billion-dollar plants. So the managers are executive VPs in the biggest companies in the world, like Cargill or ConAgra and what have you. They're big shots. They're serious guys. Although, you know, the guys I saw were kind enough to take time to show me around for a few hours. But I noticed that almost every door we went through, a guy had to unlock with a code. There was a lot of security there. I also noticed that there were big laboratories where they analyze how things are going. There were huge rooms full of computers controlling the process, which is largely done without people with shovels or brooms or spoons or whatever it is people would have if they were directly involved. The tanks, the vats are all enormous, 6, 7, 8 stories high, rooms that go on the size of, I don't know, half a football field, everything covered with ladders, and I saw by next to some ladders were safety harnesses so you could go climbing if need be. And, of course, everything was perfectly clean.
Yeah. Another process, which one of the natural products, is eggs in a Twinkie. And you actually went into how a commercially developed food uses a relatively natural product like an egg. And that took you to an interesting place. It was called Papetti's High Grade Egg Products.
Oh, that was one of the most interesting places I went. I guess there were two places that had competition for the most interesting place. But this one, I had to laugh. It was in the shadow of the Newark Airport, Newark, New Jersey Airport. A tractor trailer arrives almost every hour or more often, full of eggs, where some very, very, very talented forklift drivers empty the racks of eggs, and eventually they go into an egg-breaking machine. Now, I hadn't thought about this, but eggs have to be broken, and the bakers or other food processors don't want to have to break them. So they buy them in raw form or frozen or dried from places like Papetti's. Papetti's has these machines spinning around, breaking eggs with robot controls that look and that mimic the motion you and I make when we break an egg. It's really funny. They're doing a couple thousand an hour, but the little suction cups take each end of the egg. It's broken in half, and the two ends come up, and the stuff jumps out the middle onto what looks like a little spoon, not quite big enough to hold the whole thing. So the yolk stays there, and the white falls down, just like when you separate it into a spoon. But meanwhile, it's all whirring around, and the stuff is whisked off into waiting tank trucks that take it to, Ben & Jerry's ice cream or Hellman's mayonnaise.
And it's a liquid egg product at
this
point.
Well, depending. I mean, the tanker trucks are always taking fresh liquid eggs to bakeries, but some bakeries like it frozen and some like them dried.
Mm.
They're very stable when they're dried or frozen and much easier to handle.
And so it was a very interesting place to watch, literally crate after crate after crate after crate of eggs coming in.
Right. I just, and it was also, delightful to me because so many of the plants I visited did not have anything that looked like food coming in or going out, whereas at the egg-breaking plant, you did have eggs, recognizable farm products, coming in with feathers on them still. You know, it looked like it was food.
Yeah.
That was sort of reassuring.
I imagine one of the other interesting places that you were talking about, one of the contenders, would have been when you were investigating leavening agents. And the leavening agents are almost all mined, aren't they?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Leavening is baking powder. Chemical leavening is baking powder, like you have at home. And they use the same stuff industrially. And it comes from three kinds of rocks, which is really outrageous. I find that hilarious when you think that rocks are used to make cakes light and airy. And, in fact, in most baked goods, you're eating stuff made from five rocks. Salt is one of them. Calcium sulfate, gypsum, is another. And then the three in leavening.
The gypsum is actually mined. A lot of it's mined here in Oklahoma.
Southard, Oklahoma. That's the purest gypsum deposit in the country. It's so pure that the food quality gypsum is simply dug up and ground and put into bags. They don't have to purify it. They don't have to clean it. They don't have to heat it. But a lot of it goes to make plasterboard, you know, wallboard.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a kick out of that. And by the way, I'm thinking, wow, you know, rocks in food, you know, gypsum. I mean, my gosh, that must be some new industrially crazed idea, you know, anti-food or something. Well, no, they've been using it in food, 5,000 years maybe, in going back to ancient Japan to make tofu. It's a coagulant with soy milk.
Mm.
And it's been used in biblical times to bake bread.
The three agents, though, the three main agents in making the leavening agents are phosphate rocks, trona, and limestone. And one of the great places you did get to visit was a trona mine in southwestern Wyoming. How deep was it? Like 2,000 feet?
1,600 feet.
1,600 feet.
Which is as far down as the tallest building in the world is high. And then I got into a Jeep and drove for half an hour to find the active face. It's a big place, and it's only one of five mines in that area.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is trona? Trona is like a pure form of sodium?
Sodium carbonate. It's almost pure sodium carbonate. It's a soft rock, very pretty one. They bring it up to the surface there and crush it, heat it, purify it somewhat. They get sodium carbonate or soda ash, which is one of the most important chemicals in the world. It's used to make all kinds of things, especially detergents and glass, paper making. It's very, very important. And then at that plant, they also pipe it over as a slurry to a sodium bicarbonate plant, where it goes from sodium carbonate to sodium bicarbonate with the addition of carbon dioxide. They bubble the carbon dioxide in it, what I call the giant seltzer bottle, for not very long, and then they dry the resultant liquid.
And that's baking soda.
Baking soda, yep. Bicarb. I had a taste of it. It was fresh. It was yummy.
Really? Well, another ingredient that you see all the time on labels is cellulose gum. And this is, as you write, the key to the creamy filling.
Yep.
And what is cellulose gum other than just it's the sort of woody plant material that's part of every plant?
I suppose every plant. It is found in two plants in particular, though, that we like for food. One is cotton. Just before the seeds are squeezed to make cottonseed oil, they are defuzzed because the fuzz on cottonseeds is almost 100% cellulose. It's a great source of cellulose. Another source is another vegetable, or I should say unlikely vegetable, trees. They're processed like for paper with a lot of nasty chemicals and cooking in huge factories. But some of it is destined for food processing, so it's cleaned and completely of chemicals. And both of them make the same thing, which is eventually turned into big mats, like look like blotters, that are then ground up, treated with some more chemicals to make a white powder. I have some here. It's really neat. If you sprinkle some in water, it just turns into a gelatinous blob right away.
Mm-hmm. And it's what sort of creates the consistency so that the creamy filling doesn't leak out.
Yeah, it works a little bit with polysorbate 60. I think of it more as a fat substitute.
Oh, uh-huh.
Because even though it's almost all oil in the filling, it needs a fatty taste. And a scientist would probably tell you it creates a gel which has a certain molecular structure that's like a framework, but we don't need to go into that. What is cool is that it really helps stabilize that cream filling. Not only make it taste fatty, but it stabilizes it so the moisture stays in it and doesn't get soaked up by the sponge of the sponge cake.
It's a really fascinating book. I didn't know what I was getting into when I started opening up Twinkie Deconstructed, but it's very instructional to know these sort of ingredients, which are literally in every processed food in the grocery store, and not just Twinkies. My last question has to do with, after going through this entire journey, how are you thinking about processed foods? Are you still eating Twinkies? Are you still eating processed food?
Well, I took a bite yesterday for a TV show, but I have to say it wasn't a huge leap for me, but I'm a little more inspired to eat my fruits and vegetables, my whole foods, buy food at the local farmer's market. You know, it makes me appreciate that stuff a lot more.